Writer Patrick Ruby, every time we have him on the show, it's because he's written another fantastic piece. This one is in The Guardian, all about ESPN and how they are attempting to adapt to changing times out there. Patrick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Well, this is such a wonderful piece, and we've talked about it a bit here on the show, but you've really gone into a tremendous detail here. And more than anything else, is it safe to say that this transition is about adapting to a digital universe that maybe ESPN was a little slow to react to?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest challenge that's really facing them. You know, we can talk about some of the other shorter term stuff, the stuff where people are saying they're too liberal. We could talk about some of the job cuts they've faced and some of the big faces they've lost and some of the, criticisms that maybe ESPN is sort of not the youthful hip place it used to be and all those kinds of things. But really deep down, they're facing a business problem, a math problem. And essentially, it's kind of the same problem that my industry, print publishing industry sort of has faced, and the same problem we saw in the music industry, which is, the way things are distributed is changing, becoming more digital, and that's really affecting the way that ESPN truly makes money, and lots of money, by the way, not just a little, a lot.
Well, of course, ESPN made their bones by really getting out in front of the whole cable TV movement and establishing themselves as a network that cable providers wanted to have out there. But now we've reached a point where I think it's true that ESPN is the most expensive part of most people's cable bill.
Right. Yeah. This is something I think that maybe people don't understand totally about ESPN is they're not just a cable channel. Like, They're the most successful, arguably, cable channel of the cable TV era. Like, it's not CNN, not TBS. Nobody sort of rode the rise of cable in American homes the way ESPN did. And the genius thing they did was to realize if we could get a lot of sports people want to watch on one channel, then we could go to all the pay cable and satellite TV providers and essentially ask/force them to put our channel on their basic tier. So literally every household, every customer that gets pay TV, that gets cable, gets ESPN. And guess what? Because we have the sports that sports fans really want, we're going to charge more for our channel to those providers who then pass the cost on to the household than any other channel. So right now, ESPN runs about $7.50 a month per subscriber. Like, no other channel really gets more than like $2 a month. It's a huge advantage. And then if you add in ESPN's other channels, right, then you're ESPN2 and Classic and News, they're still getting a little bit more, so you add on to that. On top of that, Disney, which owns ESPN, is able to go to like Comcast in your local area and say, hey, you know what, you're just going to take ESPN, ESPN2, but if you want to get our Disney Kids channels, you got to take them all as part of this bundle. And it really drives Disney's ability and ESPN's ability to make a lot of money. So when ESPN makes something like $10 billion in revenue per year, like $6.5 billion of that is just from cable subscriptions. And if you think about that, most of those people who get basic cable don't ever watch sports. They don't ever watch ESPN. So you're essentially getting a huge number of Americans who don't use your product to pay for it every month. That's an ingenious business model, and it's why for many years now, for decades, ESPN has been the golden goose of Disney.
Now, John Skipper, the ESPN boss, indicated a few months back that he thought if it ever went to some sort of an a la carte world for cable or satellite, that people would be willing to pay. And I can't remember the amount, but it was an exorbitant amount that he suggested people would still be willing to pay for ESPN. But there's not a lot of research to back that up.
Yeah, that's like the $6.5 billion question for ESPN, right? So what's happening now is, as we've seen, cable subscriptions are just dropping in general. You have people who are cutting the cord, and you have millennials especially who are never signing up for cable in the first place. They get what they need on demand. They get it digitally. They get it through Netflix. It's a lot closer to a la carte, to just paying for the things you want to watch. And in ESPN's case, that means they're losing a huge chunk of that revenue we just talked about. And the more people that give up basic TV, the more of it they lose. It sort of compounds on itself. And so, next year, ESPN is going to launch an over-the-top digital service, kind of like a Netflix for ESPN sports. And I'm sure people will pay for that and subscribe. And like you said, the big question is, how much are they going to be willing to pay? Because if ESPN is losing all that revenue now from people who don't care about sports no longer having to pay for it, the people who do care about sports are going to have to make up that difference. And it could be a really big difference. I mean, we could be talking about, you know, you're going to have to pay $20 a month, $30 a month for your ESPN in order for ESPN to sort of make the same profits it's making now. And by the way, that doesn't mean that they're growing, which is what Wall Street and Disney wants them to do. That means that they're just holding the line.
We're talking with Patrick Ruby here on Downtown. And, of course, the way people watch, as you mentioned, has changed as well. People certainly not as willing to wait until a sports center to catch their highlights when they can get them from other sources digitally and almost as they happen. And it's even the same thing with games that people will watch an NFL Red Zone quite often rather than tune in for a 3.5-hour game broadcast.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing. It's like ratings for all programming across the board on TV are plummeting, and it's largely for that reason. Now, live sports have always been seen as kind of the bulwark against that because, look, people still like to watch games live, and that's true. And in a way, you know, their ratings are not dropping as precipitously. The rate of decline is much slower there, and I think there's truth to that. It's always good to watch a game live. But that said, you're right. It's also not the case that you necessarily need to watch as many games live or need to tune in to see what happened or to follow for your fantasy football team. And it's not just something like NFL Red Zone. It's all over social media. If you just need highlights, if you just need stats, all those kinds of things, it's all there for you almost instantaneously. I've talked to people who follow the NBA who literally feel like they can follow on Twitter an NBA game, a national NBA game, not watch it, and not really miss a thing. And they're not totally wrong. So that's another challenge for ESPN, no matter how ESPN is distributing itself.
Their whole embrace debate attempt at, I think, reaching a younger audience, has that been successful overall? Fox tried to copy it with limited success so far. Is that something that can work in the long term?
It's a great question, and I feel like, you know, it's all the non-game programming on something like ESPN or Fox or any sports network is extremely tangential to the actual games, and the ratings reflect that. They're so much smaller than they are for the actual games. I mean, something like SportsCenter, right, which was ESPN's flagship in the 90s, and in some ways, Beyond the Games was the thing that really branded ESPN, the thing that everybody loved about ESPN. Yeah, obviously that show doesn't really make sense anymore in a digital age where you don't need an hour's worth of highlights and jokes and analysis. Like, you can get instantaneously online, and you can get it for whatever team you actually care about. You don't have to wait for Dodgers highlights for the next two commercial breaks, right? We're not in that world anymore. So that's a challenge for ESPN, right? Because they built so much of their brand on that show. But even though you said the embrace debate shows, I think they've moved to that as a way of like, well, here's something of value we can offer. Here's something that differentiates us. But if you look at the ratings for all those kinds of shows, they're still relatively low. They're relatively low compared to what else is on cable. I think there's a business to be made there and a business to be done there, but it's just probably not nearly as lucrative as actually having the games. And the games are still really expensive. So that's the other part of the challenge facing ESPN. At a time when the profits are dropping, your expenses for games are remaining constant or even rising. And so they're squeezed a little bit. That's an issue.
Was it that that effort to reach not only the younger viewers, but also people who are used to viewing sports in a different way, what led them to what turned out to be a debacle in their brief association with Barstool?
I think so. I mean, I think that was an effort by ESPN to sort of look, their core customer is sports fans, and a lot of the core sports fans happens to be young men. That still holds true. It's not necessarily as true as it was 20, 30 years ago. But it's still the key demographic. And Barstool has been very successful, at least getting a portion of young men really interested in their product. And I think ESPN was kind of trying to buy cool in a way there. They're trying to buy cool through association. They were trying to associate themselves with sort of the funniest, hippest, most ironic part of Barstool with the pardon my take guys. It blew up in their face because Barstool is also home to a lot of like crude, off-color, off-brand stuff for ESPN. I mean, talking about the size of Tom Brady's son's package, if you will. Mm. You know, things like that. That's what it's known for. kind of sophomoric stuff that like young guys, like at least a group of them, tend to like, but it kind of doesn't jive with ESPN's older, more mature, you know, something for everybody. We're like a real news organization too, brand, which is where ESPN is now. ESPN is the same company it would have been in like the early 80s or even the 90s. And the sort of cultural climate that ESPN exists in has also changed.
Whether it was Caitlyn Jenner getting the Arthur Ashe Award for Courage at the ESPYs, the whole Jemele Hill situation. But there is this perception of a certain group of people out there that there is a liberal bias at the network. Is that accurate at all? And has that really had a significant impact on their ratings?
I would say that a lot of times liberal bias is in the eye of the beholder. So I think if you like just sort of personally and politically like reside on the right side of the spectrum and the farther right you are, the more when you look out, everything that isn't like you looks like left-wing bias. It's sort of the old when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail issue. I think there's some truth to that. I mean, I could see like somebody like Jemele Hill or the Caitlyn Jenner thing like really looking like that. Also, by the way, the Caitlyn Jenner ESPY Award, that was the highest rated ESPYs that there's ever been. I mean, I think if ESPN has a bias, it's really towards making money and getting people to tune in and watch, which is what every business has a bias towards, ultimately. I don't think that's a serious issue for ESPN in the long term. They're obviously sensitive to it. Like, I don't think they like it. I don't think they like being pulled into, you know, the White House calling for one of their people to be fired, which is what happened with Jemele Hill. I don't think they like being pulled into sort of what a divisive and toxic political climate we have in many ways in this country right now. But I will say this, in their sort of pseudo defense, I don't think they could really avoid that either. The sports world has increasingly been pulled into all that because sports exists in the real world. It's kind of hard not to be. And also, as a country in general, whole culture has become more that way. So I don't like there's nothing ESPN couldn't not cover, you know, protests of police violence and brutality via the national anthem. Right. They couldn't pretend that's not happening. They have to talk about it. They have to show it. And obviously, when you cover stuff like that, it's a divisive issue. It's a hot button issue. It's an emotional issue. Some of your viewers are going to get mad no matter how you cover it. And they're going to feel it's unfair no matter what you do. And if you have commentary that you talked about on top of that, where you have people debating it or also offering opinions on it, they're really going to get mad. So I think ESPN should probably just keep doing what they're doing and learn to live with the fact it's not 1990s. Not everyone's going to love you all the time. And you have to do what you do.
Patrick Ruby with us on Downtown. In your terrific piece on The Guardian, you talk about the deal that's in the works with 20th Century Fox and some of their entertainment assets that includes the Fox Sports regional networks. What opportunities might that provide for ESPN?
Well, I think this is, in some ways, in a very interesting and potentially very helpful deal for them. You know, in the short term, what it's going to provide is more games, more content, you know, more volume of content, more programming. When they launch their streaming service, I don't know how the contracts are all going to work, but if it's possible for them to get some of the games on there, that'll make their streaming service more attractive. Right now, the announced plan is for that streaming service to have lots of stuff that isn't on ESPN and ESPN2. So you're going to be getting a lot of the second-tier kind of stuff. Some of those local games could really qualify as first-tier stuff, like the Yankees, for instance, right? That's going to draw a big audience just in New York, and they have national interest too. And now that they've got Stanton, even more interest. So, you know, that could be really helpful. There's economies of scale with selling advertising and things like that I think ESPN could apply that will also help them make money there. In some ways, too, like I said, it sort of shores up their current business model, which still makes a lot of money of getting all those money from cable subscribers. Because there's one thing we know about the regional sports net, they work the same way ESPN does. If I'm here in Washington, D.C., Comcast Sportsnet is part of my basic Comcast cable package. I think it's like $5 a month or something for that, but that's just part of my bill, right? I can't opt out of that just yet. So I think in the short term, it not only gives ESPN more volume, but it sort of reinforces their core business that's still making them a lot of money. And that buys them a longer runway, I think, to figure out that digital transition in the long term. They're definitely smart enough to be looking at that. They're not fools.
It's a fascinating story, very well researched. As always, check it out at The Guardian, theguardian.com from Patrick Ruby. Patrick, always great talking with you. Thanks for coming back on the show with us.
Thank you for having me.